Hey, welcome to Night School, aka Nocturnal Daycare. I gotta use that. I gotta use that idea. Nocturnal Daycare. That's what this feels like. And it's daycare for me, not for anybody else. So it's been about 10 and a half months since I quit drinking. And I don't like the idea of getting any congratulations for that. On one hand, I have to give myself a little bit of positive reinforcement and credit. But I don't like the whole congratulatory aspect of something like that, at least for me, not necessarily for somebody else. I think other people, if they need that sort of congratulations in order to keep on the right track, I think that's perfect. Do it. But for me, I guess I don't like the congratulatory aspect because it was a necessity. It was a necessity for my survival and development as a person. And I don't know which one of those is more important, whether survival or development or both. But I think, development obviously requires survival in order to keep developing. And survival is pretty meaningless without continual development. But it was interesting because the first 6 months I did get bursts of like, yeah, you know, look what I'm doing. Hey, did I tell you I quit drinking? Hey, you want to talk about sobriety? You know, and I wasn't in any program. I'm still not in any program. Fortunately, one of my absolute best friends on the planet happened to have sobered up maybe half a year before me. So it was good to be able to talk to him because he's also not a bullshitter. So it was we were able to have honest, non-backpatting conversations about just the process. And that first 6 months, though, I did find myself getting, for lack of a better word, aggro about it. Like, look what I'm doing without any program, changing my life. Look at this. You know, there was a little tendency to do that. And you see athletes do that. Not that quitting drinking is an athletic feat or anything close to it, but you see athletes do that where they'll kind of talk trash and they'll kind of, not that I was talking trash, but you know what I mean? Just sort of like get that sort of like, yeah, you know, I'm doing hand motions to go along with that. Unfortunately, this is audio only. But the way that athletes will kind of, you know, have some bravado and that kind of, if they're a good player, that sort of reinforces what they do. It's like a cornerback who talks shit to a wide receiver and shuts him down or vice versa. And I think it's the same thing for doing something, anything life-changing or anything big, where you kind of get that aggro edge and it's not against anybody else, but you're kind of using it to push yourself. Because it is sort of a competition. I mean, when you're doing something like quitting drinking after spending years heavily drinking, you are in a competition. Those two actions, those two behaviors are in competition with each other. But for me, you know, the fact that it was a necessity for me, it felt like it was something I knew that I needed to do for years. And then finally doing it was just fulfilling a necessity. But after that 6 months passed, I've found myself feeling much less, I don't need to bring it up as much. I don't feel the need to talk about it as much. And part of the need to talk about it as much is when you are known as a drinker and you have a lot of relationships that are based on, hey, let's have a drink. Even if it's not a relationship based around heavily drinking or getting fucking shit-faced, like you at least... It's an easy thing to do, especially as an adult, because adulthood is so much more awkward than childhood in the sense that, like, what do you do with other adults? Yeah, there's all kinds of activities, but all that shit feels like daycare. Like, when you, like, meet up to go, like, running, which I've never done, but it's like, or, like, there's these hiking activity groups for singles to meet. I heard about this shit where it's like, and I have nothing against it. You know, I know that everything I say has, like, some sort of acerbic sound to it, but I really don't judge this stuff in all actuality. Here I am with the disclaimers, but yeah, these basically singles meet to go hiking together, and I hear that and I'm like, daycare, you're just meeting up for a voluntary daycare with the hope that you find true love or whatever. But so many adult activities are awkward and feel like daycare that it's like cool just to get a drink. That doesn't, I mean, even though bars can feel like daycare, I mean, that's the good tie-in to nocturnal daycare. That's kind of what a bar is. And there's stupid jokes, like stupid bars will say like, oh, it's daycare for your husband. drop your husband off at the bar while you go shopping, and it's his daycare. There's jokes like that. There's a bar downtown here that refers to itself. They have a banner or something that says husband daycare, and I kind of hate that, but nocturnal daycare sounds cooler than husband daycare. But anyway, you know, even though drinking is going to bars is a form of daycare unto itself, there is something just easy and cool about being like, hey, let's grab a drink. And in my case, that meant like, let's close out the bar. Let's drink. Let's have a couple drinks, which, you know, you just multiply that. And I have to say, like, since I quit drinking, I have had sips here and there. And I have kind of a philosophy about it where it's like, I don't want drinking to have this like kryptonite level power over me. I don't want it to be my kryptonite where I can't even smell it or touch it. Can't use mouthwash. You know, I understand some people, they can't have that temptation. But for me, it's like, I will ask my friends, probably disturbing them, by being like, can I have just a little sip? But I will ask for a little sip here and there. And I do mean just a sip. This isn't me saying a sip when I really mean half a drink. Like when you're drinking and you're like, oh, officer, I had a couple drinks, and you really mean like five. You know, that multiplication that you do where you, in with drinking, you tend to downplay it, at least past a certain age. When you're first getting into drinking, you, of course, love to brag. You're like, I drank 15. I drank 20 beers last night. And it's this, you want a congratulations for it. You want a medal. But the longer you drink and, you know, the more you develop an issue with it, you're more likely to kind of round down. And you don't really remember necessarily how many drinks you had, but you round down either way. But I'm not doing that with the sip thing, with the being not drinking and taking sips. And speaking of which, I need to take a sip of this green tea. A little bit of a chug. Not quite a sip, a little more of a chug. But yeah, by saying I take a sip of friends' drinks even now, it truly is just a tiny taste, a double T, tiny taste. And it's to kind of like, it's philosophically, on one hand, it's like, it's not my kryptonite. Like, I can have a taste of it without wanting to order a drink or drink more than that. And it makes it not so foreign. And I don't know, it just makes it easier for me mentally just to be like, this is not this all-powerful, magical liquid that I can't come in contact with, or it'll kill me, or it'll throw me off track. It's just alcohol, and I can taste it. It's a nice little reminder, too, why I don't want it, you know, because I never fell in love with the taste of alcohol. Like, I went through phases where it's like, oh, I love that whiskey. Oh, that's my favorite beer, things like that. But I never fell in love with it, not in the same way that I did with, say, weed, where it was like the smell of like good buds. Like, I never felt that way about alcohol like I did with weed or something like that. So someone who did, because some people do, apparently. Some people just love the smell. They love to just smell their booze. They love to really savor the taste. You think of wine tastings, and I never understood that at all. You know, I wanted my drinking, whatever I was drinking, I wanted to drink a lot of it. And if I was drinking a lot of it, I wanted it to be as pleasant as possible. And in knowing what it was doing to me, the desired result, I liked it, but I never really liked it. You know what I mean? I never loved it, would be maybe a better way to put it. So just taking that little sip, though, it helps me. It actually strengthens my discipline by having a little sip. And then second, just philosophically, I like the idea of having a little bit of what my friends are drinking in me. And that sounds fucking gross. That sounds like perverted. But really, I do. I like the idea of knowing that just a little bit of that is in my veins too, just a trace amount. So it's almost like, because that's what I miss about drinking. Like the one thing I miss isn't getting drunk. It isn't like the taste. It isn't like hanging out at a bar for 6 hours. It's that sort of camaraderie that it forms. And a lot of friends who I drank with and stuff, I still feel a level of kinship with them. Most of the people I hung out with when I was drinking, I didn't just like them because we drank together. I liked them as people, and I like them as people. You know, the thing I really liked about drinking with people, and this would extend to people who are just acquaintances, people you barely know, is that you almost like, you form this sort of it's almost like in Transformers when the smaller robots form a larger robot. Or I think Voltron was like that too. I never watched Voltron, but in Transformers, you had certain characters like the dinosaur robots. They would, I believe it was, no, it was the, there were these construction vehicle robots, and they would form this much larger guy where like one of them would be his arm, one of them would be his leg, and then somehow they would form a torso and a head. And so it was like this bigger Transformers, bigger robot who was made up of smaller robots. And drinking with a group of people is almost like that, where the more you drink together, assuming nobody has any like serious issues, the more likely you're to form this weird like symbiosis and you become this larger entity. It's like becoming the larger Transformer, except the difference is it's like he's stumbling around, and like then as the night goes on, the arm, the guy who forms the arm, he falls off, and then he trips, and then you wake up, and you're no longer all the giant Transformer. You're just a pile of junk. But you start drinking again next night, and you can form that larger Transformer again. So that's what I miss, is forming that larger Transformer, that Voltron, whatever it is. But at the same time, you know, I don't know. I'm a very independent person, and like, so it's hard to access that place sober. It's hard to be a person who wants to like get together with a group of people and just hang out all night and go on adventures, and you know, oh, we got to make sure, oh, the bar's closing, we got to make sure to get to the gas station in time before it stops selling beer so we can get like a 24 pack, because we're already not drunk enough, even though we're closing out the bar. You know, we clearly need a 24-pack to drink after 2 a.m. And, oh, you've got booze at your house? Oh, you know, it's like that sense of adventure was, it was a lot of fun, you know, especially when you're just on the cusp of being really drunk, when you're, like, not blacked out, because at that point it's just a waste. But when you were just on that cusp of like being really drunk, but you could still kind of like, you were still aware of your surroundings, that sense of adventure, of drunken adventure, is so fun. And that's an important part of this too. Some of the people I've known who have gone into recovery and quit drinking, once they do that, they take this very black and white approach. And once again, I'll say whatever works for you works for you. But people take this black and white approach where they look back on their drinking days as if it was all bad, as if it was all part of this dark pathology and this, you know, this just horrible blip in their life, you know. And for me, I look back and I'm like, I had a ton of fun. And especially early on, when I first kind of decided that I was going to go out and drink a lot and hang out with people and drink, there was so much fun. And it was really good for me. It got me out of the shell of adulthood, because I feel like adulthood sort of forces you into this weird shell. And I feel like drinking is a really great way to get out of that. And you can end up locked in a fucking literal cage, you know, if you don't keep an eye on it, and you can really fuck yourself up. But it's a great way to get out of your shell with other people and form that large Transformer. You know, I look back on those days and I'm like, that was great. And I look back on the dark parts of drinking, especially since I've stopped. I look back on the really dark times I had when the shadow sort of, you know, eclipsed me. And I think of blackout drinking that way, as like literally a shadow. It's like your mind becomes eclipsed. I think that's a good way to think of it, where you think about an eclipse, it's a complete blackout of the moon or the sun, whatever it is. I think it's the sun. Yeah. We don't understand science here, and we question science anyway. What's an eclipse anyway? Who's to say an eclipse isn't God's fist covering the sun? But really, you know, you think about a blackout when you're drunk as being, it's like your brain has been eclipsed. And I look back on the blackouts I had and I'm like, man, that was fucked up. And it's hard to think of that as a good thing, especially when it's so clearly destructive and part of a destructive pattern, and you do shitty things. Nothing like that shitty, but just when you don't represent yourself the way you want to represent yourself. Because for me, that's just horrible, no matter what, sober or not. Like, if I feel like I misrepresent myself, God, you know, it's one of the worst things I can do to myself, honestly. And I constantly feel like I misrepresent myself. But it happens a lot if you get blacked out, and that's the shadow sort of eclipsing your consciousness, really. But I even look back on those times, the darkest times, the most self-destructive, you know, the worst aspects of my drinking. And I'm like, that was a necessity to get to where I'm at now. Like I was saying, quitting drinking was a necessity, but I think that getting to that point was a necessity too. I don't think I would be able to experience this level of development and be able to prioritize the things that are important to me now and go through the things that are important to me now if I hadn't gone deep into that valley abyss. Whether it was a valley or an abyss, I don't know. But this kind of ties into the shadow, the Jungian shadow, which isn't so much a shadow as much as it is truly just the abyss of your own soul, and that abyss connects to the souls of everyone, the abyss of the soul, the abyss of the soul. But it's easy to hear that, like the Jungian shadow, and if you haven't really delved into, you know, Jung, and if you haven't really delved into your own shadow for that matter, it's easy to kind of see that as a superficial thing. Like, oh, of course, literally, I can see my own shadow. You know, everywhere I go that has a light source, I can see my own shadow on the ground. Big deal. And I think the thing about the Jungian shadow, which ties into much more ancient ideas, it's not like Carl Jung invented the idea of a human being having a shadow, you know, the soul having a shadow. It's not like he invented that, but I think there's a reason why he always gets referenced and why the Jungian shadow is so important. But it's not something you can easily see. Because you think about the things you don't like about yourself, the things you don't like about your own behavior and all of that, and it's very easy to know what those are. Even if you're in denial, you always kind of know what they are. It's almost like, you know, if you're fat and you don't like being fat, that's not your shadow. You know, you might not like your literal shadow if you aren't happy with your body, but it's like obvious things like that are not your shadow. I mean, you think about that too, because I grew up being pretty fat. Like I was definitely a fat kid through high school, through up until I was about 20, 21 maybe even. I was quite heavy, on the fat side of fat is the way I would put it. And I didn't hate myself for it, but I never felt like that was my ideal condition, and it always kind of bothered me. But one thing that happens when you're fat, especially as a kid, is that you basically go around worried, you're insecure about it, and you basically go around worried that someone's going to point out the most obvious thing about you. Because, like, when you just think about, you look at people, whether you're judging them or not, like, if you had to describe somebody, you'd be like, oh, that person's thin, that person's tall, that person's heavy. And when you're fat, it's like you're worried basically that someone is going to describe you. You live your life in constant terror, and maybe that's an exaggeration. Like, I don't remember being, like, terrified of it. But there's a part of you that in you go into a situation, and you're worried. You're just worried that someone's going to describe you. So I feel like the shadow, the Jungian shadow, it's not something that somebody else can just easily point out about you. You know, if you're close to them, if you have a long relationship with them, if you're romantically involved with them, if they're an old friend, a family member, there's a good chance that they're going to pick up on things going on inside of you that do relate to that deeper shadow abyss, that valley abyss. I don't know why that sounds good to me or if it makes any sense. But you thought you were going into a valley, but it turned out it was an endless abyss. But it's not going to be superficial things, or even if it's like, oh, I don't like that I get angry so easy, or I don't like that I'm mean to my, you know, sister, you know, things like that. Like, that's not going to be the best example of your actual shadow either. But when you actually look at all these things, like your insecurities or your anger problem or just various things going on inside of you that you know are bad, whether you want to deal with them or not, and those are ultimately coming from the shadow. I think that's a good way to think of it. And this is just my interpretation. I'm not saying I'm an expert on Jung. You know, I've read a couple of his books. I've listened to a lot of people's analysis of him. You know, everything kind of comes back to Young. That's another thing, too, is so much comes back to him. It's hard to avoid. It's almost, sometimes it almost feels synchronistic, which it feels cheap to say since he is kind of the godfather of synchronicity, which, like The Shadow, he didn't invent the concept. People have been experiencing synchronistic phenomena since, I'm sure, as long as there's been life on this planet. But he did write the book Synchronicity. He did investigate it very deeply, invented the term synchronicity. So it feels cheap to say that Young appears in some sort of synchronistic way. And it feels especially cheap because I don't think it is synchronistic. I think that Young's influence is so extensive and it relates to so many different fields. And so many people have taken influence from him in spirituality, psychology, even science. Art, it's just his influence is so universal that saying that when Young comes up thinking that that's synchronistic, it's almost like saying it's a synchronicity that the sun rises every morning. And that doesn't mean you can't appreciate the phenomena, you know, because to me, it's a phenomenon that Young comes up as much as he does, that that man existed, that he came up with so many ideas, especially about ancient things as well as modern, and particularly the subconscious bridge between the modern and the ancient. I mean, that's, to me, one of his biggest things, the collective unconscious, all of that. It's bridging a gap between the earliest known human consciousness and the present day consciousness and the unconscious, the subconscious, just all of that. But yeah, it's to me like pointing out some sort of weird coincidence with Carl Jung is basically like thinking like, oh, the moon came out tonight. Isn't that crazy? It was out last night too. Can you believe it? And some people need to search for meaning, and I might be guilty of that myself, where you end up like searching for meaning in everything and trying to find those synchronicities or those signs. But you don't have to think of it as a big deal to appreciate just the basic phenomenon that it is. Phenomenon. I always forget which one I'm using. Phenomenal phenomena. And Carl Jung, he is an absolute phenomenon. and so you have to appreciate that, just that he does come up so much, just on that basic level. But to get back to what I was saying about The Shadow itself, it's like you think about those things, those superficial things, and they're not necessarily like outward. They're not necessarily like physical things you don't like about yourself, or things that are obvious on the outside, or even things that are on the surface, you know, of your inside. But those things come from that deeper shadow. Those dark things that you're aware of come from the much deeper shadow. And you can think of it, think of those things almost like the dead flowers, you know, decorating the tree that comes from your shadow. Like those little superficial things. I don't like this about myself. Oh, why am I such an asshole in this situation? Why do I drink so much? Why do I do that? Those are like the wilted flowers on, you know, a much larger root system. And I think Jung even explained it that way, that the roots of the shadow go all the way down to hell. So it's definitely a root. The shadow is the root of it all. And that's why, like, just calling it a shadow almost doesn't seem like enough, because a shadow is just very easy to see and identify. But the shadow is a shallow way of actually describing what the shadow is, the shallow shadow, when in reality it is that much deeper abyss. And I think that abyss, it almost goes beyond words or explanation. It's based on a much deeper feeling. And when you can't easily explain it in words, and it's hard to even comprehend when you're thinking about your own shadow, it's no wonder that it's so hard to actually work on that part of yourself. I mean, people can go to their psychiatrist, their psychologist, and just blame their parents for everything for their whole lives. That gets them by. They just go, oh, I have all these problems. Well, I'm going to go, or I have all these issues that I'm dealing with mentally. And like, oh, my parents were imperfect or shitty, or, you know, and once again, that's like one of those like starving kids in Africa things where you can always say to someone, well, yeah, well, you're not a starving kid in Africa. And it's easy to say that about someone who, say, had like a relatively good childhood and like has these issues with their parents. Like one parent was aloof, one parent was, you know, verbally abusive, but they ultimately provided for their kid, and their kid had, you know, the good outweighed the bad, but the kid just can't seem to get over the bad. And it's easy to like look at that person and be like, You know, there were kids who got like fucking molested by their stepdad and their mom was aware of it and did nothing about it. You know, there's situations like that. And I think that's where perspective is important. But you can't force perspective onto somebody without, I mean, it just becomes mean almost when someone just, say someone is blaming their overall decent parents for all of their problems. It's like, it's not really your place to be like, yeah, well, you had it good compared to, you know, Molly down the street who was getting slapped around every night. You know what I mean? Like, it's not your place to tell them that, but you just want to hope that they get some perspective, because it's basically a never ending chain of like not addressing your own responsibility. Where it's like you can go to that therapist forever and blame your parents and find out, oh, your parents were highly imperfect. Well, maybe your parents need to go to therapy too. And then your parents go to therapy and you find out their parents had problems. And it's like, so they blame their parents and then their parents are dead. So why don't we dig up your grandparents? Because, you know, they made your parents the way they are and your parents made you the way you are. So let's dig up your grandparents and make them go to therapy and talk about their parents. And it's like this never-ending process where you never really accomplish anything. And there's a reason why that stereotype is true of someone going to therapy to talk about their parents. You think about The Sopranos and the early episodes of that, like the Dr. Melfi brings up Tony's mom, and Tony's like, oh, this is where, you know, you're just going to get me to like blame everything on my mom. So it's a common trope, but there's a reason it's such a common trope. It's almost like the used car salesman that had to like the used car salesman had to exist before the used car salesman became a stereotype or a trope. But it's ultimately kind of useless in my opinion to just continually focus on those things. But it's easy to focus on those things. It's easy to focus on the wilted flowers, or maybe the wilted flowers, maybe your own issues are those wilted flowers, but then the branches are your parents. And then, so that's the next thing you focus on. You focus on the obvious shitty things you're doing, or the things you feel about yourself, the wilted flowers. Then the next step is, oh, what are the things that made me who I am? These controlling, you know, factors, these influencing factors, and then you focus on those. But the shadow goes so much deeper than that. And I think drinking for me got me in touch directly with my own shadow. And it would be easy to say, oh, drinking was the shadow, or this was it. You know, it'd be very easy to focus on a lot of what I would consider more superficial issues that I had to work through. And I wouldn't be able to explain how I addressed the shadow. I mean, I think I could, but it would take, you know, I don't know how many episodes. Nocturnal Daycare Night School would be a 10-hour an episode show, and I wouldn't get anywhere. I'd probably just be saying exactly what I'm saying now anyway. You know, I wouldn't be able to break down like how I addressed that and how I dealt with it, but I do feel like I did, and I am in the process of dealing with it. And it is a process. I think so many things to me, it's my new thing that I just can't stop saying, but I just became aware of how many things are a process and accepting that it's a process without a clear goal. Because going back to, you know, the quitting drinking thing and feeling this initial rush of enthusiasm the first 6 months where it was like I was just chomping at the bit to kind of drop, oh, I quit drinking. Here's what I'm experiencing. Here's what I'm going through. Here are the sensations I'm feeling quitting drinking. Here's how I feel about quitting drinking. And it's something that we all do when we do something new, especially if it feels good or excites us in some way. And things like that are like really important lifestyle changes, quitting drinking, working out. I know I experienced it when I first started meditating and I had a breakthrough where I felt like I was actually doing what I was actually getting something out of that experience. So what did I want to do after that? Tell everybody. I did a fucking podcast about it. Oh, I started meditating last week and I had a really cool experience. Guess what I'm going to do? Do a fucking hour long podcast about it. That's what I did. And I'm very self-conscious about that. But I also, you have to give yourself a break and be like, it's fun to be excited about something, and getting excited about something reinforces it. If you don't have breakthroughs and if you don't feel excitement, you don't really want to keep doing something. It's like if you're trying to play basketball and you just never make a basket, you're not going to want to play. you're going to reach a point where you're like, you know, I've been practicing basketball so fucking much and I still haven't been able to shoot a single three-pointer. I haven't been able to shoot a single three-pointer. And why do I want to do this? You know, you ultimately have to have those experiences if you're going to keep doing something. But it's easy to be giddy about it. It's easy to be glib, to use a word that I learned from Tom Cruise years ago. It's easy to just, like, you just want to tell people about it and talk about it. It's almost like you have a new interest. It's like there's a new band you got into, and, oh, you just want to tell everybody about that band. You want to talk about that band. It's a new show. But with things that are related to discipline and real life changes, you just have to let them become normal. You have to let that excitement die down. And once that excitement dies down, you just have to keep doing them. And you have to understand that I'm not always going to feel excited about this. I have to understand that this is sort of the new normal for me. And not sort of. It really is the new normal. I made a change. I quit drinking, and for me, it's indefinite. I'm not going to throw a rake down on my path up ahead so that I can step on it and say, oh, I'm never going to drink again. I'm not going to say that, but I will say that my current decision to quit drinking is indefinite. And I have to realize that I'm not always going to feel super excited and empowered by that. And so far, I've been lucky in that I haven't had a desire to drink. However, I'm not going to get overconfident and say, oh, that's never going to happen. I'm never going to want to drink again. You know, I'm not going to say that. Why would I say that? Why would I want to step on that rake? Especially because it's probably covered in spikes. It's like a rake, like it's like half spiked bat, half rake, and you step on it and the handle has a fucking nail in it that goes right into your forehead. You know, you have to get out of your own way though. And, That's just going to continue to be something that I have to do. I have to continue to get out of my own way and just, and let, I don't know. Right when I said, I don't know, my fridge does this crazy buzzing sound. It's awful. Right when I said that, it just dropped so I could just be left alone here with my thoughts. But yeah, it's to get back to that idea of things becoming the new normal for you and not being exciting. It's almost like watching a new TV show where you're just so excited and then you watch all the episodes and then you wait a while and you rewatch them. But you reach a point where you might not want to rewatch it all. You might not want to keep watching the same show over and over again. But with things that are much more important to your well-being, lifestyle, health, you can't just let it become a show you don't want to watch anymore because it's not a show. And you have to be willing to power through it when there's no excitement or even when you don't want to do it, even when something's telling you to you know, eat the donut or, you know, buy a bottle of whiskey. You have to be ready to deal with that. And I think everything comes down to just a decision, and you don't even realize when you're making a decision. And I think that's been an important part of quitting drinking for me, is realizing that I have the power to make the decision to not order that first drink. And I know from past experience that after I order that first drink, my ability to make the decision to order the second drink or third drink or 10th, 20th drink sometimes becomes diminished. So you have to recognize where do you have the ability to make a decision? Where do you have control over your decisions? And for me, that's at zero. I can easily go to a bar, and I do it all the time. I meet up with friends at bars still to this day, and I make the decision to not order that first drink. I can take a sip. I have the self-control to take a sip and to not want to order that drink, but I cannot order that first drink or it's lights out. I know that from experience. I know that from when I tried to dial back at previous times when I tried to control my drinking. It's like a light switch. It's, you know, some light switches have a dimmer. Some people can put that dimmer on. They can go out and order three or four drinks and feel fine with that. Maybe that's even a lot to them. Maybe that's a wild night for them. For me, it's like it's a light switch where it's either drinking or not drinking, and I can easily control the ability to not drink. But once I try to start drinking, once I try to have one or two, even if I successfully have one or two drinks or three or four or five, even if I limit myself to five drinks, the whole rest of the night, I'm sitting there thinking about how bad I want that sixth drink. So basically, once I commit to the idea of drinking, I just want to drink all night. So it's much easier just to say, I don't need that first drink. It's the same thing with a bag of chips. You know, if I get a bag of chips, if I get that bag of chips, it's much easier to just not eat chips at all than it is to try to have one serving or one chip. Which reminds me of a funny story where when I was growing up, we had one of my sister's friends would babysit me, and we referred her to a friend of mine so she could babysit him. And she called my mom one night and she was like, I'm babysitting Eric's friend. And his mom left me these really detailed instructions. But one of the instructions is that if he's hungry before dinner, he can have one chip. And that just seemed like such torture. It's like, why not just say he can't have any chips? But it became this inside joke that my mom and I still bring up where it's like, one chip. He can have one chip. That's sadistic. And it's sadistic to me to have one drink because I'm just going to sit there wanting that other one. And yeah, maybe it would be a good exercise in discipline to learn how to just have that one drink, but it's not really, because it's not like that one drink is good for me. And that's the thing about discipline. I would rather use the energy that I put toward discipline toward doing things that are 100% good for me. I'd rather develop discipline that is based around running every day, working out, eating well, getting enough sleep, because I never used to get enough sleep. that'll be another episode. So I'd much rather use that discipline for things that ultimately have a benefit to my life rather than using that discipline to moderate something that serves no purpose, at least at this point. I'm not saying alcohol didn't serve a very good purpose for me at earlier points in my life, because I think it did. As I said, you know, I don't look back on my drinking days as some, like, I wish I never did it. I'm so glad I went through that. I am so glad I was a drinker. I would not be where I'm at now, even though I'm still suffering, and I hate to say suffering, but it's true. I'm still suffering from things that I did to my body from when I would get just fucked up all the time. I still have chronic issues that I might live with forever. But even then, I am so glad I went through that, because I am where I am now because of that. I've had certain revelations. As I said, like, I wouldn't have been able to prioritize the things that are important to me now if I hadn't deprioritized them then. So, you know, the commitment to, you know, implementing disciplines that will ultimately make my life better is so much more important than using discipline to try to control things that have no value or even hurt me. So thank you for listening. I'm sure I'll have more to say on this subject in the future. And for now, though, it's just, you know, I feel like I'm on the path I need to be on, and I know that I will continue to step on rakes. I know that I will continue to get in my own way. But, I recognize where I have control and where I have opportunities to make decisions or not make decisions. Because I never even, just to go back to the chip thing, like, it's almost like the same idea as having the drink, where it's like, if there are chips in the cupboard, I never thought of it as a decision to go and get one. It was almost like this unconscious thing. And I think people who overeat do that. And if I'm stoned, everything's out the window. If I'm stoned, I'm just going for that bag of chips. I'm just unconscious at that point. I'm basically just this, like, specter hovering around, just, like, looking for food around my house. Recognizing that, oh, I have the decision to not go get that one chip. I have the ability to make that decision. And I think that's where all of this starts when it comes to making life changes. You identify where you have the ability to make a decision, and you make the decision there, not later on, you know, after you've already made that initial decision that's going to make future decisions harder.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. this brave, this golden land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and